is Gail Weisberg speaking with Fanny Cohen, side 4, May 9th. Continue, Fanny. I'm sorry.
All right, now.
We were talking about.
Oh, yes, yes. And the albumin. They discovered albumin, which is indicative of a kidney, loss of albumin, indicative of a kidney problem.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, let's see, that was had to be maybe 1942, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Up until. Well, at least 30 to 72. For at least 30 years, he was checked regularly by the doctor, and his situation, albumin situation, did not change. In other words, he did not have to go to the Army because of this.
Mm-hmm.
He was uninsurable because of this.
Oh, my.
But he was very fortunate because usually this is a beginning, and it's a disease that goes continuously gets worse.
Mm-hmm.
And not until he was till about 1970, maybe 3 or 4 years before he died, which would have been 1974, the doctor discovered that there was a little more albumin, and then it began to get worse and worse until such time as his kidney failed completely and he had to go on dialysis. I can't remember how long it was on dialysis, but I think it was almost a year, at least a year and a half. But he was able to function during all that.
And when he was on dialysis, he still played in the different
yes.
symphonies?
Yeah, he played in the Pittsburgh Symphony and was still personnel manager. After a while, he gave up playing and just became personnel manager. But he was able to continue because of the cooperation of the dialysis center here. They would schedule his 3-time-a-week dialysis treatments
mm-hmm.
to coincide with his schedule at the Pittsburgh Symphony.
Hmm.
I have another article here about how, well, of course he got dialysis here in Pittsburgh. He got dialysis treatments in Abington in Philadelphia.
Why was he there?
Because the Pittsburgh Symphony was playing in the Ambler Music Festival at Temple University.
I see. Did they do that for many years?
Yes, they did that for quite a few years. We also, he got treatments at the Hammett Hospital in Erie because we spent part of the summer at Chautauqua, New York, and Erie was the closest dialysis center. And there, too, again, Ed just will remember, I was determined that this man was going to go wherever he had to go.
Mm-hmm.
And he was somewhat determined, too, but I have to take the credit for just pushing with all my might. And arranging for all these things and not taking no. Nothing wasn't possible.
Mm-hmm.
And the dialysis centers were all very cooperative and wonderful. And so we were in 3 different places. He would get that. Oh, even in Florida. We went to Florida 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And he had dialysis treatment in Florida.
What was the dialysis treatment always the same in every location?
Yeah, they have the machines which mm-hmm. they hook up to your arm. They just they cleanse your body of the poisons that are in your system.
How did he feel? Was he able to do anything while he was sitting there?
No, it was very difficult because he was a very restless man. And it was very difficult. Sometimes he would go to sleep. But most of the time, they had little TVs. Some of the dialysis centers, the one at St. Francis, as I remember, had little TVs.
Mm-hmm.
And his most enjoyable time, and to this day I can't watch Archie Bunker because that was what gave my husband the most pleasure when he was laying in the chair. And I can't watch it
without
now because without thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
But they had little TVs hooked onto all the chairs. Now I don't remember that they had them in Erie. Of course, there's a lot of commotion around because the nurses are moving around a great deal. And there are other patients, little kids.
I see.
Older people,
mm-hmm.
How do you feel? How do you not feel? You know, there are a lot of movement around. It was very difficult.
How long did a treatment take?
Sometimes 5 hours, 3 to 5 hours, and that's a
long. 3 times a week.
3 times. It's a long time to be on your back in a position. Oh, then he'd always get something to eat while he was on dialysis because that helped to. I'd bring his lunch, and that would help to pass the time.
But so it was almost a whole day by the time you would sometimes travel to and
right.
from.
Right. Well,
the treatment.
In Pittsburgh, it was St. Francis Hospital, and we were there in a very short time.
Uh-huh. But when you were away,
going
to
Erie was an hour's drive. We'd get up at 6 o'clock, leave at 6 o'clock in the morning, and have his treatment, and I don't think I'd get back till 3 o'clock, and then I was loved to swim, so with all my might, I'd go down to the beach and get in the water. At Philadelphia, it was about a half an hour or two. Sometimes his friends would take him, but I mostly didn't.
Did you love to swim as a young girl, too?
I loved the water. Oh, sure, at the Irene Kaufman Center. That taught us everything. You did everything.
Uh-huh.
You sang, you swam, you danced. You played games, then you went to Emma Farm.
Uh-huh.
I must have told you I went to Emma Farm.
About Emma Farm.
And you swam at Emma Farm, too. Mm-hmm.
So
no, those communities.
You still swim today, right?
Oh, right now I'm swimming 3 times a week, a quarter of a mile 3 times a week.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, for health reasons mainly, but because I enjoy it too.
Uh-huh.
I have a good reason to force myself to go, no matter what else happens. Oh boy, we really got off the track here, didn't we?
No, we're not really off the track.
No.
In fact, it was probably more about Sydney that you'll come up with. But we did one thing you were going to tell us about his sister Carolyn, who died, you said, at 31.
Oh, yes. Well, that, of course, was a very sad story. Well, the death of a young, marvelous young woman who was very much like Sydney, absolutely precious, had a routine hysterectomy and had peritonitis and died. And she was in a hospital in Long Island. And my mother-in-law loved that girl, well, as every mother loves a child, but there was a relationship between them that was marvelous. My mother-in-law was desperate. It was the most terrible thing to deal with her because you didn't know what you could do to help her. And my husband really never cared if we had children. I was very busy with my career. He was busy. I don't know why. I think he was kind of like a child himself. I think he didn't want the intrusion. I think he just wanted me all to himself, or whatever. And one day I said to my mother-in-law, Mom, how would you like it if we had a child? Of course, like all grandmothers, when are you going to have, after you get married, the next question is, when are the kids coming, okay? And of course, she was trying to be discreet, but we were married for a long time. And she would, every once in a while, say, you know, you don't realize what you're missing. It's wonderful to have a baby, and you should have a child. You know, I just, you know, compared to women now, I was a career woman then. If any young woman says to me now, well, I'm not going to have a child because I want my career, I would absolutely say that they didn't realize what they were missing. But this was 29 years ago that my mother-in-law was saying this to me when women were all getting married and having babies.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. So anyway, I said, how would you feel if we had a child? And of course, the idea just brightened her life. And soon after that, I got pregnant, and we had Carl, and Carl is named for Caroline.
Mm-hmm.
And that changed her whole life. Not only did she have a grandchild, and here I'm a Jewish mother talking about my child, but she had a sweet young man who was very considerate, and who, when Grandma was around, he'd take off her coat, and what can I do for you, and he was so sweet and wonderful with her, that in between, she was in New York, I mean, but in between the visits, she just got together with all her lady friends, and you know how they all talk about their grandchildren. Anna Cohen had the best one in the whole world. Her little Carl was marvelous, and that's how Carl, really, the inspiration for Carl, and that was his name. And it was a very touching, marvelous experience. Of course, aside from what it did for my mother-in-law, I can't imagine why anybody would be without a child.
How old was Caroline when she died?
31.
Was she married at the time?
She had just been married. No children.
Isn't that a tragedy?
Yeah, right. It was a terrible tragedy. I will never forget it as long as I live. So that was the story of that situation.
When we talked to you last time, we were talking about your different moves and where you lived when you were first married with Sydney.
Yes.
Do you remember when you moved here to Solway Street?
Yes, it was 1955. May of 1955.
What? Here we are, May again.
Mm-hmm. May 1st is moving day.
In Pittsburgh.
Well, it's moving day in Pittsburgh.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Here, I have something here, too, and maybe we touched on this last time. Why did Sidney Lowe no longer play in the Chautauqua Symphony?
Oh, yes. Well, the Pittsburgh Symphony, for many years, was a short season. At one time it was 18 weeks, 20 weeks, maybe 30 weeks, and then he had his summers free, so he played in the Chautauqua Symphony. But when the Pittsburgh Symphony changed its season to full year, 52 weeks, mm-hmm. then every musician was under contract with the Pittsburgh Symphony for a full year, mm-hmm. so they couldn't take any other jobs. They had to be available.
When did they switch to the 52 weeks, about, do you remember?
Yeah, I really can't. Remember, it's a long time ago. I could look it up because
even when he wasn't playing the Chautauqua Symphony, you continued to go up there.
I was not going to leave Chautauqua, uh-huh. nor was my son going to be eliminated from Chautauqua. That uh-huh. was our summer home, and I loved it so. And my husband always had at least 4 weeks off between seasons. Even though they went to a 52-week season, they always had at least 4 weeks vacation. So I would take our cottage or our apartment for the whole summer, and he would spend whatever time he could there, and my son and I would stay the whole summer, and I would visit him in Ambler in Temple University,
uh-huh.
maybe for a week. Oh, he'd shack up with his buddies, his orchestra buddies. They had a great time, the boys, and I would go there maybe once during the summer and scrub the kitchen and clean the stove, and they didn't really appreciate me particularly. I was really in the way, but they had a good time. And that's what he would do, how I would stay there.
One of the questions I have is, when you told us that Sidney was the personal manager, it also meant that he was a player. And can you player in the symphony?
That's right.
Can you explain to me, what does a personal manager do?
A personnel manager. I will read again. May
okay.
I?
Sure.
This was a page from the Pittsburgh Symphony program called The Symphony is People.
Uh-huh.
Sidney Cohen's office has an old sofa, squat and upholstered in green, and a desk. He seems to work standing up and on the run. The swivel chair has been pushed back to the corner. He puts things on it. Mr. Cohen is the personnel manager of the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra, and that makes his office one of the busiest places in Hinds Hall. He has an amazing amount of responsibilities as personnel manager. He sees that rehearsals and concerts are scheduled according to the regulations of the musicians' contracts. He also makes sure that the musicians know where to be, when, and what will be played. A more difficult part of his job concerns employee relations. Mr. Cohen mediates many of the differences of opinion that inevitably arise between 106 creative people, their conductors, and the people upstairs, the management and staff. He says, I have a very peculiar position. I was appointed by the Pittsburgh Symphony Society, but I'm still a member of the local musicians union. I am therefore aware of the feelings of the men. I am also aware of the feelings of the conductor and the feelings of management. All I can do is try to be fair and equitable to all concerned according to the rules. And this article further says, Mr. Cohen is full-time orchestra member, the violist to your right in the second stand, and evidently the combination of roles has worked well for him and everyone else. He has been personnel manager since 1947.
So how many years did he do it? How many years was he the personnel manager?
Well, then 47 until the time he died. Well, that would have been 30 years. Close to 30 years. Now, I have to say that the role, because of the growth of the Pittsburgh Symphony and the changes in some of the administrative structure, some of the things that Sidney, my husband, was responsible for, the current personnel manager is no longer responsible for. At the time he was there, he was the man who, with Dr. Steinberg, would more or less choose the orchestra members' auditions and more or less work the whole personnel thing out. Now there is a players' committee and there is an orchestra committee, mm-hmm. and the manager gets into contract negotiations. So the job as personnel manager has a slightly different structure now, but mm-hmm. this was what it was, and I think this states it very well.
Mm-hmm.
I have a really a lot of material of him that was put in print, and that's why I have access to all this information that's quoted directly from someone who can say it better than I can.
I can't believe that we are going to run out of tape in about 15 minutes.
Uh-huh.
You had one more question.
I know.
It's
about the viola.
Yeah.
You think I should go? Okay, then I will ask
that
now.
You're
right. Okay. I was going to say that because I wanted to get the Gateway to Music.
No,
I wanted to ask you about Sidney's viola that you had told us that you were still saving.
All right, I have to read again.
Good.
Okay, this
what
is
are
an
you
article
from
called.
This time?
Written in 1955
mm-hmm.
by James Ball,
mm-hmm.
the Pittsburgh Press. It's called Three Century Viola. And now I'm quoting from the article. Sidney Cohn has just bought an old second-hand viola, and he's as proud of it as though it was brand new. Actually, the instrument is more than second-hand. It was made in 1683
yes.
by the Amati brothers of Cremona, Italy, has been played during these nearly 300 years by a succession of great violists, and now does its bit toward making the Pittsburgh Symphony String Section the great one it is.
Hmm.
Mr. Cohen, who is personnel manager, values his, quote, new instrument at about $5,000. The papers date back, and I must say that every fine instrument has papers which authenticate it.
I see.
The papers date back to 1901, when the viola found its way into the hands of Lyon and Healy, Chicago dealers. Shortly afterward, it was purchased by E.L. Wingate of Boston, who played it in the Boston Symphony for 45 years. Then the instrument was purchased by David Schwartz, former principal violist of the Detroit Symphony. Now, then the next guy thing says how the deal was made. Are you interested
sure.
in?
Sure, yeah, we'd love to hear.
Mr. Cohn, who has been looking for the right instrument for 20 years, heard about this exceptional viola from the well-known violinist Misha Mishikov. Mr. Cohn tried out the instrument last summer, liked it, but couldn't come to terms with the owner. Finally, mutual friends interceded, brought the two together, and the deal was made. Mr. Cohn financed the viola through an unusual arrangement by which it is possible for Pittsburgh Symphony players to buy instruments without too much strain on their bank accounts, reasoning that the better the instruments the Pittsburgh players own, the better the music they can make for Pittsburgh audiences. Charles Denby, president of the Pittsburgh Symphony Society, arranged with the Buell Foundation for a grant of $10,000 as a, quote, revolving fund for purchases of instruments. And by the way, this was my husband's idea. Mr. Cohen's Amati viola figured in one of a series of practical jokes perpetrated by symphony players, but I won't go into that. That's a real funny story, but I won't go into that. But many of the, and I don't know whether that fund still exists today. Of course, now $10,000 is nothing for a fund. They have, if it's going to be useful, it would have to be much larger because instruments cost a whole lot. But the symphony member may borrow from this fund to buy his instrument and repay it without interest over a three-year
mm-hmm.
period.
Mm-hmm.
And during the time that my husband got his instrument, there were many others who were getting them that way. I can't give you what the current situation is now, but as I say, they'd have to have a lot. I mean, his instrument, he named it then the 5,000 in 1955. I still have the instrument, by the way. It's got to be at least 15,000 now, maybe 20,000.
Mm-hmm.
I really have not had it appraised in recent years. So, and this was not, I mean, that's not considered a terribly expensive instrument.
Do you have to store the viola in a special way, or?
Well, I try to keep it in, I have it in somebody's air-conditioned apartment right now. I used to keep it here, but then the summers created a problem. The apartment got too hot. I do want to keep it for sentimental and other reasons. I still would like to have it played by somebody in the Pittsburgh Symphony, but I have not been able to work that out. I still
so the instrument should be played.
It should be played, yes, but it is not played on. It hasn't been played on except occasionally when a few people would like to, just wanted to try it out.
Mm-hmm.
That has not been played, but I still have the instrument, and I hope it's safely stored away.
I hope so.
In an air-conditioned apartment.
Well, it's a pretty old viola, and certainly it wasn't stored in air conditioning. You know, if you said, what was it, 1683?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I didn't think about that. Well, I was concerned about intense heat, but they must have known how to take care of their instruments.
Is it in the original case that it was in?
No, he had the cases were changed. Uh-huh. Yeah. And he has had different bows, too. But he had to buy a new case for it. I don't remember what it came in. It must have come in some flimsy case. But, you know, I didn't realize that instrument was played in the Boston Symphony for 45 years. I'd forgotten about that part of it.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. It really is.
Yeah.
Can we Xerox that article?
Sure. We can Xerox anything.
I think this is
Well, we can Xerox it.
I think I pulled all these out for you because
of
these are extras.
Okay.
I have. You can have
okay,
all of
if
these.
You're short.
Absolutely,
fine.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
No problem.
Mm-hmm.
How much time do we have left on the tape? Maybe
we have about 10 minutes.
Do you want to do that for 10 minutes? Or don't you, I really should pull down here and see what we
I
would
still
like.
Would like to talk about Gateway to Music. I think that's so important. Do you think you want to hold that off to
Well, I
I'd rather hold it
three.
Off. I don't want to push that just for 10 minutes.
Okay.
Well, of course, with these books, you know, I almost have to go through. I just put little markers in where I thought you might have some interest.
All right, so
and
let's see where you
sure.
have.
Well, let's
try
back,
Fanny.
Let's back to Fanny Cohen was on a high honor roll when she graduated from University of Pittsburgh.
Uh-huh.
Wow. 1934. Here I am.
Uh-huh.
27 take highest honors with quality point average of 3.0.
I'm not surprised, Fanny.
Well, I was.
I'm impressed.
Isn't
that nice? Yes.
And here's my first ticket. The first Pittsburgh Symphony.
Do you believe that? When you had just started working
there? I had just started to work there Wednesday evening, October 17, 1934.
How much was the ticket, did it say?
No, but it had to be a lot cheaper than what
right.
it is now. It had to be
my.
A whole lot cheaper. But I felt very sentimental about, you can see about, well,
obviously
I'm sort of a record keeper
that.
Anyway. And these things meant a lot to me. They meant an awful lot to me. So I kept that. Well, that's all that's there.
I have
several letters from world famous conductors that were for me alone. This is from Otto Klemperer,
mm-hmm.
who was one of the greatest conductors that ever lived. And he was conductor, he's the one that chose my husband, right?
Right.
Now, you can either Xerox a copy of this, or
uh-huh.
I can read it to put in your tape.
Let's read it.
I was.
But we can also zero.
Oh, this is another sign of the times. I was Miss Mattis in those days.
Uh-huh.
Nobody called in an office called anybody by their first name.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, they wouldn't dare with Fanny Mattis because I was very strict and quite dignified.
Uh-huh.
I'm not showing that dignity now,
oh,
but I was very proper. Anyway, this is dear. You know, Dr. Klemper was dear Miss Mattis. May I take the liberty to give you a little souvenir, this is in quotes, in recognition of all the work you did for me in these weeks. In spite of all the hard work you did daily, I assure you, you helped me very much to come along, and I'm only extremely sorry that I can't come more in the office to thank you personally. Perhaps I see you in one of the concerts. If you don't like the little thing he had given me again, please change it. Good luck. Very best greetings. Yours very truly, Klemperer First.
So could we photocopy that?
Sure.
Sure. Thank
you. Okay, I'm going to put a little marker there. Then I have, if we're getting into letters of that kind,
uh-huh.
This is from Fritz Reiner, who
my.
Came after Klemperer. This is Christmas 1946. Dear Fanny, this little gift will serve a double purpose. One, I want you to see a pretty face every time you look into it. Two, I want you to remember at least once a day your grateful friend, Fritz
Aww.
Reiner. Isn't that nice?
Very
Beautiful.
Nice. Mm-hmm. What was it, a little mirror?
No, that's another thing. People don't, of course, these are Europeans. And Fritz Reiner was not, I shouldn't say this in the type, he was not all that gracious a person. I mean, he was tough on the podium. Very tough of the earth. But he was not really that gracious a person. I have one more from Victor de Sabato. If I could come across it now easily, I would like so we could have all of these wonderful letters to together, but I'm not sure.
Go ahead, Lil. We have time.
This lay, well, your tape is going, and that makes me feel that I should be.
You have another tape.
Here's a whole lot of the stuff in this book. I'm going to get to the father to do, but he wrote me a very sweet note, too.
Do we know how to spell Victor DeSalvati?
D E capital D small e capital S A B A T A. No, I mean, I put markers in. Oh, I have also a beautiful letter when I left the Pittsburgh Symphony in 1951 from Mrs.
Is that it?
This is it.
Let's see what that is.
This is from Mrs. Edward Rose Babcock, who was a beautiful, wonderful lady. Her husband was mayor of the city of Pittsburgh at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And that time she was treasurer of the Pittsburgh Symphony Society. That's when I left. And also a wonderful letter from Richard Rau, R-A-U-H, was a great old name in the Pittsburgh Jewish community. His widow still lives, Helen Wayne Rau.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Rau was very, his mother was Mrs. Enoch Rau. That name probably means nothing to either of you. A great leader.
What do they have to say, Fanny?
Well, now, Richard Rau, this is when I left the Pittsburgh Symphony in 1951.
Mm-hmm.
It says, Helen joins me in an attempt to tell you, however inadequately, how very much you have meant to both of us throughout the 17 years in which you have officiated as Eddie's right-hand bower. You have been a tower of strength to the symphony, and you have been a very wonderful guiding hand in the progress of the symphony movement. In addition to your superlative services, you have been a friend to both of us at all times. May you enjoy the leisure that now comes to you, and may you return to us every so often in the future as further proof, if proof were needed, of your abiding interest. Our gratitude for everything that you have done to help the cause of music in Pittsburgh, and our affection and devotion always. Sincerely, Dick. Now, Mrs. Babcock's letter says, Dear Miss Mattis, there's Miss Mattis. Oh, she would never have called me by my first name. I mean, this was a tall, lovely. You know where she lived? On Ellsworth Avenue. You know the two decorators who bought the house at the corner of Ellsworth and
Aiken.
Not St. James Place.
Right. It was on the decorator showcase one year.
Right. That was Mrs. Babcock's house.
Down by Winchester Thurston School?
Yes.
Yeah.
Dear Miss Mattis, this letter, this little package, the little package contained a gorgeous gold bracelet with an inscription beside it. expresses many loving thoughts and appreciation for the countless gracious, thoughtful acts you have done for the board of the Women's Association of the Pittsburgh Symphony Society. We will miss you very much, but you are entitled to a change, but we hope you will get homesick to see us. You have many loyal, admiring friends, all wishing God's blessing on you and yours. Most cordially, Mary A. Babcock. You know, I'm really blowing my own horn here
today. We are interviewing you, so this is wonderful.
Yeah, there is still
one. I don't
see
how we could have a more organized person to talk to either. I don't see.
Well, I'm ashamed of these books because you can see how yellow they are with age, and I really. Just a few summers
Danny,
ago.
You're not yellow with age, so
no,
don't
thank
worry
God,
about
thank
it.
God I'm not. But I really should really repay. Something.
Listen, look at this.
Yes, yeah. This is from Kaufman's Downstairs ad,
1957. Mm-hmm.
Address for $3.99.
Here it says, this is part of your Shifley embroidered no iron. Oh, they had no iron dresses then. Of Everglaze cotton that washes so easily. $3.99.
And what was on the back of this ad?
This happened to be a story about William Steinberg and his wife. Oh, you know, that's interesting. You know what else I have? Is a program, one program, symphony program of every year. And if we're talking about ads, there are ads in every one of these programs.
Changed.
And how they have changed.
How did you decide which one to keep every year?
I wanted the symphony often would publish a program that listed all the works that were performed that year and who the guest conductors and artists were. And I thought that was the one to say.
I see.
Now, I still have this one, although I was not part of it. Pardon me, somebody gave me this 1927, the very first Pittsburgh Symphony.
They gave it to the right person, Fanny, because you have certainly
and
saved
here's
it.
An ad for Frank and Cedars. You don't know what Frank and Cedars
I remember it. It's long gone.
We're talking about digging history.
Uh-huh.
Here's Kaufman and Bears, which was the forerunner of Gimbel's.
Oh, I didn't know that.
We could really dig. We could dig a lot of history out of just looking at some of these programs that were.
We're going to run out of time, but we can continue.
That was the first symphony program.
But I was not with the symphony. That was the inaugural.
Do you know when this runs out, Idris?
April 24th, 1927.
Right now?
Yeah. What number?